I'd like to thank Professor Wong for the opportunity to speak here this week. Today I'm going to talk about Wiener's Lemma for the Heisenberg Group. This work was supervised by my advisor, Thomas Stromer. So I'm a grad student and a professor. Okay. So the outline is I'm going to give motivation from harmonic analysis and then also from mogul communications, very much in the spirit of Professor Groschnig's talk from this morning. Then I'm going to state our integral operator result. That's our main result. It's an integral operator on, say, LP of the Heisenberg group. Okay. As a consequence of that, we fairly easily get the convolution operator on the Heisenberg group. And that's in that convolution operator, that's where we're going to have our Heisenberg lemma, or our Wiener's lemma. Lastly, I'm going to show how the ideas that we use here, they either simplify or they just give us nice easy consequences for twisted convolution, some differential operators in a certain class, and then consequently also for our mobile communications model. All right, so Wiener's lemma. Wiener's lemma states that if you have a periodic function that is nowhere zero and it has an absolutely convergent Fourier series, then it's invertible and its inverse also has an absolutely convergent Fourier series. Okay? This is done in a commutative setting. All right, so we're going to take a special angle on this lemma, and this is the perspective that is really the foundation for the work that I use here from the 40s and 50s and 60s, but also for the last 15 years or so, 10 to 15 years. Okay, so we're going to look at a large Banach algebra and then a subalgebra, and we're going to look at invertibility within the subalgebra. Okay, so typically in this work, the subalgebra is given by some form of L1 decay. All right. So, for example, when we look in the usual Wiener setting, we can look at these guys as a Toeplitz matrix algebra, and then we look at the off-diagonal decay of the Toeplitz matrix. Okay. So that's where we see the off-diagonal decay already in Wiener's lemma. All right. So this is what a Wiener-type theorem looks like. And almost all of the theorems that I'm going to use in the next 40 minutes are of this form. Some of these algebras don't have an identity, so when I write tilde, that means that I've adjoined the identity to the algebra. Okay. So the first fundamental result in my area, following Wiener's lemma, is this theorem by Buchner and Phillips. So essentially what they say is that I can take my coefficients an here from a Banach algebra, and in particular from a non-commutative Banach algebra. Okay, so that is the first step towards getting an operator type Wiener's lemma. Okay, so I'm going to use different projections on my space, and I'm going to use this part of the lemma to get my operator value Wiener's lemma. Okay. So the next big step, although it's fairly recent, I guess, is Gochberg, Kossuth, and Werdemann, and independently Baskakov, did exactly this. So they set up projections. They make a partition for my space, which I'm going to talk about later. But imagine I have, say, if I'm looking at LP of R, I just chop R up into intervals, okay, and I and J is the I from J's interval. I project onto LP of that little interval. I look at what my operator does, and then I project again. So now I have an operator-valued matrix. All right. Now the sum of all of these projections gives me back my entire operator. But now if I look at a particular diagonal, and I look at the norm of that diagonal, it's going to be the supremum along the diagonal. Okay, so this is a operator-valued matrix, yet the theorem that we have for just regular scalar valued matrices still holds. Okay, so this is and in fact the proof by Goldberg, Kossoff, and Verderman is very informative, very easy to understand. Bhaskar's is more difficult, but he incorporates weights and takes a different perspective. So that's the direction we're going. And what we essentially want to do for the Heisenberg group is take what we want to do in the Heisenberg group and make it compatible with these ideas. And that's what we did in this work. Okay. So weights, as we discussed this morning, is something that we also include. Here we have the GRS condition, which gives how strong of a decay is preserved in an inverse. And as Charlie said this morning, if we have too strong a decay, if we have too strong a decay in the original, we can't guarantee that in the inverse. Okay, in particular, exponential decay won't be preserved. Okay, so when I speak about a group, even means I take the inverse of an element. So G of A, take the inverse. Okay, so we use weights, they're not too tricky to work with. Okay, so Bhaskar incorporated weights in his proof. All right, so here's what we have is, if I have this weighted decay of my operator valued matrix, then that operator is invertible, then its inverse also has the same off diagonal decay. Okay, so one way to look at that is that these operators, they for the most part leave subspaces invariant. So this is a measure on how much the operator moves subspaces or leaves them as they are. Okay, so Kurbatov was kind of the key. So my advisor found this paper by Kurbatov and he handed it to me and said, see what we can do with this for pseudo-differential operators. Okay, so what Kurbatov does here, and uses ideas very similar to Bhaskar, the two of those guys have done very similar work. He is able to take a step further and look at an operator majorized by a convolution operator. Okay, so T is some linear operator, and I say it's majorized by a function in L1. So now I still see my off-diagonal decay there. Right, this will be the key for us. Alright, so those are the backgrounds, those are the theorems that I used in this work, and this is a handful of recent results of the same nature. All of these here are fundamentally about twisted convolution groups and their dual groups, translation, modulation, different operators formulated by translation and modulation. Okay, and as we've seen yesterday and today, that really speaks for looking at the Heisenberg group. So we have this fundamental non-commutativity, and Since translations and modulations don't form a group in their own right, we adjoin the torus to get group structure. Okay. Now this is what convolution, I'm going to use star for convolution on the Heisenberg group, will look like. All right. So the question, and the assumption is that the Heisenberg group lies at the foundation of a lot of the twisted convolution and the other things that it's done. So hopefully there should be, what works for the Heisenberg group should somehow have consequences for the others. For example, in some cases you can look at the different classes on G by G hat as a restriction of your functions in here, so a special class of these guys. All right. So the harmonic analysis question is this guy inverse closed with respect to group convolution? All right, now I'm going to briefly give the mobile communications motivation, which is how we originally got on this topic. So when we transmit a signal, okay, it's a wave. What happens is it bounces off the walls, as we saw this morning, and what you receive is delayed copies of the original signal. When there's movement involved, there's also a Doppler shift, which is a frequency shift. So what we receive is then this weighted collection of translated and modulated copies of the original. What we want to do is we want to essentially invert this operator. Now, what we have to do is, and this was the question asked this morning, you have to estimate the channel. So we have to estimate L sigma by sending what's called pilots. So assume, but as Professor Grishnik said, that's a different side of the puzzle. But now suppose we have our estimate of the channel. Okay, that's what we call this operator. Now we want to invert it. So suppose I have a big matrix that's my approximation of this operator. What I'd like to do is truncate to just several diagonals and invert it, and know that my inverse of the truncated matrix is still capturing the majority of the true inverse. So if I know that my channel is invertible and my channel is in this class, well, then I know that its inverse will have the same orthogonal decay. So my truncated inverse is still going to be a good approximation. All right, that's a very simple motivation for how we can use this property in practice. Okay. So here's again the vial symbol. And composition rule for the vial symbol is given here by twisted convolution. I guess I don't have twisted convolution on this slide, maybe. Well, I define that later, but that's G by G hat with a phase term. Okay? So, in fact, initially we started with this operator. And the question was, hey, can we use Kurbatov to invert this operator? And we just kept pushing it back all the way to the Heisenberg group. Okay, so we'll see that the ideas used for the Heisenberg group can also essentially solve this problem for us. In fact, this problem falls out as a consequence of our other work. Okay, so here's our integral operator theorem for the Heisenberg group. I assume that my kernel has, again, off-diagonal decay. So what that kernel is going to do in a heuristic sense is it's going to leave subspaces invariant. Okay, that's how I look at it. Okay, so this is our main theorem for the Heisenberg group. Now again, as I said, the way we prove it is by making our Heisenberg setting compatible with the work of Goldberg, Kasuk, and Verdemann. All right. So first I set up these two classes. This is the top N1V. That class is the class I'm really trying to work with. And as a step to getting there, I'm going to work with N infinity V. Okay, so N infinity V is this subclass that has extremely nice properties. All right. N infinity V takes the most, again, these I'm going to get to describing what these Q, J, and QK are, but they're just boxes of the space. It's the best class and that it takes the broadest functions, the most inclusive set of functions to the most restrictive. Okay? And what I can apply Baskakov here. Alright. So the two steps to the proof, the two most important parts, the trickiest parts, is to show, really most importantly, that this guy is a two-sided ideal in the larger space of operators. So we show that, and then we make this partition setup compatible with Baskakov. Okay, and then from there we're okay. All right. So again, what we need here is we need a discrete commutative group as my index set. And the Heisenberg group doesn't give you a commutative subgroup in that way. If I take a subgroup for G and a subgroup for G hat, and I multiply them, I'm always going to get phase terms in there. Okay, so I'm not going to get a discrete subgroup like you'd like to have right off the bat. So I use the standard trick. Here's the standard trick for getting your discrete subgroup. We use it again for G by G hat, okay? And now I kind of break with the tradition and I just add the torus on there. All right? And so now I have my discrete subgroup and a set of boxes that partition LP of H. Okay? So now we have our discrete subgroup, even though we're dealing for the most part with a non-commutative group, or we have the abelian subgroup that we need. Okay, so now I have to introduce several pieces. The partition, that's what we just developed, is exactly that, a subset, not necessarily a subgroup, but a subset with a compact subgroup. Okay, and we use the amalgam spaces, which I view as local LP norm, big LP, and global little LQ. We show that, in fact, the class of operators N infinity V is equivalent to integral operators with kernels in this amalgam space. Okay? So now for that two-sided ideal property that I need, I can really look at the amalgam spaces rather than the operators directly. So again, this is these two calculations is really what gives us that this. You know, that's the two-sided ideal property. And so with that, we're on our way. But again, this is non-commutative, of course. And this right here, we have to prove this for any partition. So we don't choose the partition. We have to prove this for any partition. Okay? The integration for H, since H is unimodular, really simplifies things. So even though it's non-commutative, when you integrate, a lot of the difficulties really wash out. So that's the little tricky part, is proving that. Okay, so here's the idea of the proof. First of all, N, the identity is not part of my space N1V, okay, because the identity wouldn't be majorized by a function in L1. All right, so therefore, if that operator is invertible, alpha I plus N, then alpha must be non-zero. Okay. I used my density property. Okay. This is essentially Kurbatov's idea right here. But I use my density property, and then here, with the density two-sided ideal property, I can express alpha I plus n in this class N1V. Here we use the two-sided ideal property very literally, whereas in the original Wiener's lemma, you're not invertible if you're not part of any maximal ideal, that type of thing. So here it's used literally. Okay. So there's the integral operator too. Now we fairly readily get their convolution result. All right, in that we apply the inverse. We know that the inverse is in that class, but we want to show that it's also a convolution operator. We can express it as a convolution operator with, you know, convolution with a function in that class. So we apply it to a proximate identity. We get this limit. And then we apply this. Okay, this little snippet was actually we took from Professor Grifshank, one of his papers. So I think I should have a one here, by the way. But so that's how we can show that, in fact, this operator is invertible. Convolution with this function is invertible. Its inverse is in this class, and it can be expressed as convolution with such a function. All right. So there is Wiener's lemma for the Heisenberg group. Okay. Kurbatov, his original result is up top for a locally compact abelian group. Okay. And in twisted convolution, which I have now defined here, defined that way, we have essentially the same results for the Heisenberg group, but with G by G hat and convolution using just the same ideas that we just discussed. Okay, that also comes up. So, before I go to the pseudo-differential operators and show how we can get our pseudo-differential operator result that we wanted, I'm just going to talk a little bit more about the appropriate symbol class. Because originally I said, okay, we have a pseudo-differential operator, it looks like this, but now I have to justify why I take my symbol in L1. Okay? So, I look at the symbol as a convolution with a function, and in time I convolve with a different function. Okay, so the function that I'm going to convolve with changes over time. All right, this can be looked at in two ways. First, in this description, these two are equivalent. I'm going to say that the function I'm going to convolve with has an L1 Fourier transform, and that the change over time in the function that I'm given, that I'm going to convolve with, that change is also, so I'm talking about how much it changes. Well, its change is given by being Fourier transform L1. Okay, so that means it changes in a certain moderate fashion. Okay, so that's equivalent to what I have here, but this is a little bit easier to understand, a little bit more direct. That says that here I just have, this is going to be compact support, and that's it's a little too rigid maybe. The L1 change is, I think, a better description. But we can just call it compact and therefore L1. And so the Doppler effect is going to be bounded by your maximum speed and the angles, etc., right? So these things in practice are all bounded. So my support for my modulation is compact, and as a result, L1. Okay, and then my symbols are also going to be band limited in nature. So the support of my spreading function will be limited to the frequency support of my signal that I'm going to transmit plus the maximum Doppler spread. Okay. So as a easy consequence of the previous theorem on twisted convolution, we have by the composition rule for the pseudo-differential operators, this Banach, this Wiener's lemma for the Banach algebra of Weyl pseudo-differential operators with sigma in L1, sigma hat in L1. Okay, so they're bounded. It's bounded, closed, and inverse closed. And then, as I said earlier, that means that my matrix orthogonal K in my model, my channel model, is preserved in the inverse. So for computation, that's essential. Okay, that's how short the proof is for that theorem now. So, any questions? Yeah, that's all. Thank you.